This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 2nd, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, a judge in Pennsylvania rules the state's controversial voter ID law won't be implemented before November's election. As two candidates prepare for presidential debates, third-party candidates take legal action to demand fair treatment and access to the debate. And black lung disease is on the rise among Southern Appalachian miners. Scientists and health advocates are trying to figure out why. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Before daybreak this morning, authorities in Bahrain jailed at least five medics whose sentences were upheld on appeal by a civilian court yesterday. 20 medical professionals were arrested last year during pro-democracy uprisings, charged with using the Salmania Medical Complex as an opposition stronghold. They were later tried and convicted in a military court. The Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry found they were tortured during their initial detention, and most of the charges were reversed by a civilian court. At the height of the March 2011 uprisings, Dr. Ali Al-Ekri spoke to Al Jazeera at the hospital.
They have to stop this brutal attack against the Bahraini citizens. They are innocent. Okay. No weapons. Please.
Al-Ekri was sentenced to 5 years. Human rights groups say the doctors and nurses are guilty only of treating the wounded and exercising free speech. Tens of thousands of miners in South Africa continue strikes, calling for increased wages. One company demanded that workers show up to meetings today or lose their jobs. Davison Madzingwa reports.
Mining giant Anglo-American Platinum's South African operations have been gravely affected by a two-week-old wildcat strike. The company threatened to dismiss workers who stayed away from disciplinary hearings today. Some strikers did attend, but not all workers followed the order. At least 21,000 miners began the strike, demanding a monthly salary of $2,000. Their employer says that is unaffordable and out of bargaining guidelines. The mining sector has been hard hit by protests in the past 2 months, affecting the country's economy. Analysts say the spreading protests were spurred by strikers at Lonmin's mine that netted workers a 22% salary rise. Anglo-American is also facing legal action brought by former miners who contracted silicosis during their work with Anglo-American's now defunct gold operations. The 18 say the lung disease was a result of excessive dust they inhaled during their years of service. The case will be heard next year. Davison Mzingwa, FSRN, Cape Town.
In Tunis today, a woman who says two police officers raped her went before a judge who will decide if indecency charges should be filed against her. At the courthouse, hundreds of women rallied in her support. In early September, police came upon the woman and her fiancé in a car. She says one of the officers held the man down while the other two sexually assaulted her. The officers have been charged with rape, but both the woman and her fiancé could face indecency charges. Tunisia is currently drafting a new constitution, and women are concerned they could lose rights under the country's current leadership. With only a fraction of votes counted, Georgia's president has quickly conceded his party's defeat. MJ Del Valle has more from Tbilisi.
Thousands of people celebrated in Tbilisi last night in hopes of a victory by the coalition Georgia Dream. Today, their dreams were realized when current President Mikhail Saakashvili conceded the defeat of his party, the United National Movement. The Georgian Dream now faces some major challenges, not the least of which is how they will be able to govern together, given that the coalition is made up of six very different parties. Another issue is that until constitutional amendments come into effect next year, Georgia is still a presidential system, so power remains in the hands of current President Mikhail Saakashvili. And the leader of the Georgian Dream, Bitsina Ivanishvili, will have to find a way to successfully achieve two seemingly contradictory goals: improve relations with Russia while getting Georgia established as a member of NATO. MJ Del Valle, FSRN, Tbilisi.
A Cambodian judge has sentenced a popular independent broadcaster to 20 years in prison on charges his supporters say are baseless and a human rights group says is a crackdown on free speech and dissent. Erwin Loy reports from Phnom Penh.
71-year-old Mom Sananda ran Beehive Radio, a rare independent media outlet. Hundreds of his supporters rallied outside a Phnom Penh courthouse Monday. As the verdict was announced, angry demonstrators tried to reach the building but were pushed back by police in riot gear. Sananda was accused of trying to incite a group of villagers in eastern Cambodia to revolt against the government. But rights groups say Cambodia is using the courts to silence its critics, as well as groups that encourage people facing land evictions to stand up for their rights. U Virak leads the Cambodian Center for Human Rights.
I'm very, very upset given the fact that we've been doing this, we've been pushing this country, this government for almost two decades now. You know, and it hasn't changed. A court is still a political tool.
The government denies such accusations. Still, rights groups are already gearing up for more time in court. On the same day Sananda was sentenced, Virak was one of four people summoned to appear in court later this month. They're accused of incitement. Erwin Loy, FSRN, Phnom Penh.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doran Marina in Los Angeles. With just 5 weeks to go before Election Day, voting rights advocates are scrambling to register voters, educate communities about new voter ID laws, and respond to accounts of voter intimidation. Many welcome today's decision by a Pennsylvania judge to halt the state's contested voter ID law, saying the ruling will prevent disenfranchisement of voters. But some watchdogs remained concerned about other states following allegations that a company hired by the Republican National Committee to work in battleground states has committed selective registration and fraud. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Tuesday's partial preliminary injunction against Pennsylvania's voter ID law means that voters will be asked to show ID at the polls during this upcoming election, but can still cast a ballot if they lack one. The law is now set to take effect next year, but the judge set a hearing for December to further examine the issue. Rashad Robinson with the civil rights organization Color of Change remains concerned that the mixed ruling will send a mixed message to voters.
The state of Pennsylvania is still, at this point, moving forward with this education program to educate voters about ID. We understand how confusing that's going to be to many folks, sort of on one hand, hearing information that you need to show an ID up on billboards or on the radio or on television, and now having the court say that folks don't actually need to present this really selective, narrow set of IDs at the polls.
Other groups, including the NAACP, say they'll continue their legal challenges to the law next year and will monitor the polls closely in November to make sure no one is improperly turned away. Advocates in Florida are also concerned that some voters could face barriers come Election Day due to the state's recent voter purge that swept up many legitimate voters and developing fraud allegations against a voter registration group hired by the Florida Republican Party. Election officials in at least 12 counties are now poring over thousands of forms submitted by Strategic Allied Consulting after wrong addresses, missing social security numbers, and other errors were discovered in Palm Beach County last week. Blogger Brad Friedman has been investigating how this scandal could impact voters.
The election officials that I've talked to out there are rather concerned that what could end up happening is voters show up on November 6th and they're disenfranchised because many of the cases had existing voters who had their addresses changed. And in Florida, if you show up to the polling place and you are no longer registered at that particular polling place, you'll have to cast a provisional ballot. And by state law, if you cast a provisional ballot at a precinct that is not your own, election officials aren't even allowed to open the envelope to count your vote.
One of those officials is Leon County Election Supervisor Ion Sancho. After the Florida Republican Party filed an official criminal fraud complaint against Strategic Allied Consulting last Friday, he and all other election administrators across the state began scrambling to review the forms submitted by the company.
We've received about 300 of these applications, and we're going through them now. There are a lot of inaccuracies. There's some incomplete forms, and it will take quite a while before we actually can ascertain whether or not there's actual fraud going on.
Over the past 2 years, the Republican-controlled Florida legislature has approved many voting restrictions they say were aimed at preventing fraud. These included purges of the voter rolls, cuts to early voting times, and a series of burdensome rules for third-party registration groups that were later struck down. Sancho said these new revelations about Strategic Allied Consulting call the state leaders' motives into question.
The irony is that the only voter fraud identifiable in any kind of systematic way in the state of Florida is that done by the Republican Party's own agency to do voter registration.
The Republican parties of Colorado, North Carolina, and Virginia have also fired Strategic Allied Consultants at the urging of the RNC. The company released a statement in response this week saying it has never tolerated even minimal violations of election law. But Friedman says its leader, longtime Republican strategist Nathan Sproul, has a questionable track record.
Workers for this company, Strategic Allied Consulting, are said to have torn up Democratic voter registrations and thrown them away. And that's exactly what Nathan Sproul's other companies have been accused of over the years in state after state, in election after election.
Sproul previously ran the Lincoln Strategy Group and Sproul & Associates. He was hired as a consultant by Mitt Romney's campaign last year and worked on John McCain and George Bush's campaigns before that. Sproul recently told Friedman and other reporters that the RNC specifically asked him to create a new company for this election season and not have his name associated with it. As Florida investigates these claims, Maryland Democrat Elijah Cummings is launching a federal inquiry. He wrote to Sproul this week demanding copies of all his contracts and correspondence with the RNC and state political parties, the documents establishing the company, all materials used for voter registration training, and any other information about voter registration irregularities. Cummings also called Sproul to testify before the House Oversight Committee on October 12th. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
As attention on access to the ballot continues, presidential candidates are preparing for tomorrow's first national debate in Denver, Colorado. But the stage is once again set for only two of the presidential candidates to participate. That's Democrat Barack Obama and Republican Mitt Romney. None of the third-party candidates are being allowed to participate. According to the Commission on Presidential Debates, the organization that runs the event, a candidate must demonstrate support from at least 15% of the national electorate and be on the ballot in enough states to theoretically win the Electoral College. The Libertarian Party is challenging that criteria. They say the exclusion of Libertarian Party presidential candidate Gary Johnson from the debate is a violation of federal antitrust laws. For more, we're joined by Jim Gray. He's the vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party and a retired California Supreme Court judge. He's also arguing the motion in court. Judge Jim Gray, welcome to FSRN.
Well, thank you, Dorian. It's just nice to be with good people. We always welcome the opportunity to discuss issues and programs.
First, lay out your primary legal argument for this specific lawsuit and how you're challenging Johnson's exclusion from the presidential debates.
Well, of course. You know, it really is a rigged job that in 1988, the League of Women Voters that used to be instrumental in overseeing the presidential debates actually withdrew because the Republicans and Democrats had gotten so much power that the League of Women Voters did not even want their name to be attached to it. They call it the hoodwinking of the American people, and so they've not been involved since. Then you can look and see that the last time a third party was asked to be a part of those debates was 1992 with Ross Perot, where he was polling at 7% when invited to participate in the debates, and then he ended up getting 19% of the electoral votes. So then you can see, well, the Republicans and Democrats got together on the commission, and they're the only ones that make up this Presidential Debates Commission, and decided, look, guys, you know, we don't want that to happen again. So they've raised the bar at an unachievable level. So we believe that it is an antitrust violation. These three parties, namely the Republican National Party, the Democratic National Party, and the Commission on Presidential Debates, are as private entities just conspiring to restrain trade. And what more important competition is there in the country than the competition to become president of the United States?
Part of that argument, according to your lawsuit, relies on the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which is known for breaking up monopolies during that time, such as Standard Oil. How does that principle apply to presidential debates?
Well, it's talked about competition in the marketplace. And, of course, not only the marketplace of ideas, but the president, of course, who is elected president affects commerce probably more than anything else we could think of. And the Sherman Act laws should apply to it. That has not yet been adjudicated. We didn't even get this hearing. We'll have to bring another action probably before the next debate, which will be the vice presidential debate in Kentucky.
So the debate scheduled for tomorrow is likely to go forward. You were seeking to enjoin the debate, right?
Yes, indeed, or without including any party that would have enough be on the ballots in enough states to be able to technically win the election.
And again, at this point, your candidacy on the ballot in 47 states in the District of Columbia, is that correct?
Yes, probably Pennsylvania as well will be our 48th, but only Oklahoma and Michigan are up in the air.
You mentioned as part of this lawsuit naming the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, but also the organization that runs the debates, the Commission on Presidential Debates. It was set up in 1987. It describes itself as a nonprofit, nonpartisan group whose purpose is to, quote, provide the best possible information to viewers and listeners. Now, Governor Johnson and your party are not just criticizing the exclusion of third-party candidates, whether they be Libertarian or from the Green Party, but the format of the debate itself. What about how the debates are run?
Well, again, the Republicans and Democratic Party are in charge of this, and so they have basically demanded, as I understand it, that the questions be pre-screened and be previously told to the presidential candidates. We think that is not in the spirit of a neutral debate. We feel that the question should be open-ended. And if we are not in the debates, there are numbers of issues that simply will not be discussed because Romney and Obama are the same. They don't want, for example, to discuss the so-called Patriot Act, a direct frontal assault on our civil liberties. They are in favor of it. Governor Johnson's against it. So they don't want to discuss these issues. The same thing with the war on drugs, treating marijuana like alcohol, where there are initiatives on the states of Colorado, Washington, and Oregon that would treat marijuana like alcohol. Governor Johnson is in favor of these initiatives in those three states. They are not. They don't want to discuss them. We would require them to be discussed. So it's clearly important for the American voters to be able to address all of the issues and not just the pre-screened ones from the Democrat and Republican candidates.
Well, let's get into some of those issues and what you're seeking to bring to the debate. Wednesday's debate is scheduled to take on three main topics: the economy, healthcare, and the role of government. What proposals does your candidacy have with regards to these topics that differ from the Democratic or Republican Party?
Well, the huge issue around the country is jobs. And you can look at all of these ads. Republicans and Democrats have spent hundreds of millions of dollars putting their ads out on the radio and television. But what we would do for jobs, they're nibbling at the edges. We would repeal the income tax. Now, what difference does that make? Well, honestly, our goods, be it agricultural or manufactured, have a competitive disadvantage now competing with other goods around the world. First of all, as exports, they paid taxes on them before they leave our shores, competing with other goods around the world that have not. So it makes our goods artificially more expensive. This is hugely important. This will bring back prosperity to our country in the Midwest, the Northwest, everywhere, because we will again become manufacturing again. It is something that's really exciting. Only Governor Gary Johnson and Judge Jim Gray will bring this home.
Jim Gray is vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party. Judge Gray, thank you for joining us.
Well, absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity. Good luck to us all.
You can find an extended interview with Jim Gray on the libertarian positions on healthcare, the environment, taxes, and more on our website, fsrn.org. Polls officially opened in Ohio today as part of early voting in the battleground state. Many voters turned out in order to be among the first to cast their votes. As FSRN's Evan Davis reports, some in urban areas had been camping outside the polling places since late last night.
More than 100 students, labor activists, and concerned citizens pitched tents and braved the wet, frigid weather outside Franklin County's early voting facility as part of a statewide Get Out the Vote effort. They were joined by State Senator Charlita Tavares, a member of Ohio's Progressive Caucus.
One of the reasons we were so excited about early voting and providing opportunities for everyone to vote early is so that we didn't have the problem of the inequitable distribution of voting machines. People wouldn't have to stand in line for 2.5 hours, 5 hours, 12 hours to vote. This makes it convenient and easy for all of our citizens, and that's what we should want.
Students are one demographic that benefit from having early access to the polls, and some of them, like Michael Flanagan, helped organize the Sleep Out the Vote event. The third-year Ohio State University student says the enthusiasm is growing on campus, where many of his peers favor Democratic candidates.
What the media doesn't understand is I don't think they get the connection that young people have with this president. We have a connection with him because he's fighting for us. He believes in us. He's trying to make changes for us. And we see it every day on campus. The excitement's there. We've already registered more people to vote than the OA campaign has. I think there has never been in any election a more clear, different choice, a more clear, different vision for America. Everybody talked about 08 as the most important election of our lifetime. It was historic because of President Obama. This is the most important election of our lifetime. This will set the course for this country that we're going to inherit in a couple decades.
Although Ohio's early voting facilities are now open, their hours of operation are shorter than they were during the last two elections, following an order issued by Republican Secretary of State John Husted. The question of whether the polls will be open on the weekend before election as they were in 2008 is the subject of a legal battle between Husted and voting rights advocates. Husted initially forbade weekend voting, but when a federal court overturned his ruling, he appealed. A ruling on that appeal is expected soon. Evan Davis, FSRN, Columbus, Ohio.
Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters to you. You've made a commitment to listen to the progressive, fearless, independent journalism we produce daily. With 200 freelance journalists around the globe, FSRN is on the ground where crisis occurs and where the news of the day affects local communities. We have led the way in covering many critical issues, from the effects of state laws on undocumented immigrants and the battle for voters' rights, to the attacks on women around the world and the response to climate change on the grassroots level. No one else can bring you this coverage the way we do. Find out more about how to support FSRN, a choice that matters, by going to our website, fsrn.org. Coal miners in southern Appalachia are experiencing a spike in cases of black lung disease, which results from inhaling coal dust. The disease has killed tens of thousands of miners over the past century. Federal legislation was supposed to take care of the problem. After the 1969 Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act came into effect, black lung disease plummeted, but now it's on the rebound, affecting younger as well as older miners. Researchers are trying to find out why. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports from coal country in southern West Virginia.
In the 1960s, former West Virginia Congress member Ken Heckler led the fight for passage of the Miners' Health and Safety Bill. President Richard Nixon signed it in December 1969. At that time, 4 in 10 underground miners had some evidence of coal workers' pneumoconiosis, also called black lung, which made breathing difficult and for many eventually led to their deaths. Heckler said the law had an impact on the disease.
It certainly helped to reduce it, but those of us who were strong supporters would like to have seen black lung eliminated entirely.
That wasn't going to happen because testing for coal dust was left largely up to the mine owners themselves. Heckler, who's almost 98 and is still active on mine safety issues, says mining companies subverted the law in many ways.
One of which was to lie about the amount of coal dust in their mines. When they were asked to test the amount of coal dust officially, they would make the test in areas of the mines where there was not as much coal dust as there was in other parts of the mine.
Federal law requires that miners diagnosed with black lung receive some level of compensation, but a diagnosis is often hard to come by. Ralph Coffey worked underground for almost 30 years until he was seriously injured in a mining accident. His story is similar to many miners who received conflicting information, sometimes from doctors employed by coal companies.
Well, where they send you compensation and everything, they tag you, you ain't got it. And then your regular doctors tell you you got it. Where they x-rayed you if you've had pneumonia or something, they find it.
Meanwhile, Coffey says it circumscribed his life.
Kind of slows down your breathing, puts you short-winded and everything. You can't do what you used to. But as long as a miner's living, he don't get nothing. Maybe his family might get it later on.
Applying for compensation for black lung is a long, complicated process. Dr. Dan Doyle runs the Black Lung Clinic at the New River Health Center in Fayette County and says his job goes beyond diagnosis and treatment.
And a lot of our work with them is what we call advocacy or benefits counseling, because many of them have ongoing claims with state workers' compensation or with the Department of Labor for federal black lung benefits. So a lot of the primary care physician's work with them is helping them get paperwork done, helping them have certifications signed.
The incidence of black lung in miners went down to 2 or 3% after the 1969 law was implemented, but it has risen in the past 15 years to around 10%, says Dr. Donald Rasmussen, who is considered the nation's top expert on black lung. And more serious cases are showing up in younger miners. It can present the same symptoms as smoking, but can be identified through a high-resolution CT scan, which reveals small round opacities in the lungs. No one knows for sure why black lung is on the rise. Researchers at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health are looking into it. Rasmussen is 84 and still working full-time as a pulmonologist in Beckley, West Virginia. And he campaigned with Congressmember Heckler to get the bill passed. He says some possible explanations for the rise in black lung are that miners are working longer hours, that the region has more small mines, which tend to have poorer ventilation, and that new machinery to access narrow coal seams has raised the risk.
When the machines grind through the rock, they liberate more silica, and it's freshly fractured, which at that time it's more toxic.
Non-union miners outnumber members of the United Mine Workers Union more than 2-to-1 throughout Appalachia, and Rasmussen believes that's another factor in the increase in black lung.
In a non-union mine, if you decline to do something because you say it's not safe, they just say, well, fine, you're done. And they have no recourse in the UMW. There are contract protections.
In late July, West Virginia's senior U.S. Senator Jay Rockefeller reintroduced mine safety legislation that failed in two previous years. Among other provisions, it prohibits mine operators from keeping two sets of books that hide actual conditions in the mines, establishes strict penalties for unsafe ventilation changes, and limits miners' exposure to coal dust. So far, it has just three co-sponsors, including West Virginia's other U.S. Senator and former governor, Joe Manchin. But no one from any other coal state has signed on. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, Raleigh County, West Virginia.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.